Hey friends, thanks for tuning in to the Church Planner Podcast. Before we started today, wanted to tell you about a really special opportunity our friends at the Micro Church Conference put on by Brave Future, happening April 18th through the 20th in Kansas City. This is for all of you who are wondering what is a new kind of paradigm for missional church planting and church multiplication through smaller expressions of church, what they call rediscovering the smaller way. It's happening April 18th through the 20th. Kansas City is being hosted by Kansas City Underground. Going to be a great weekend. And they've given us four free registrations to give away. Normally the price is $90, but we will get you into the conference for free. We have four of those. What you can do to enter is go on our Instagram at Church Planter Podcast. And there you'll find a DM button. Click that DM button. Send us a DM with your email on it and your name and where you serve. So email, name, where you serve, and you'll be entered to win one of four Micro Church Conference registrations. You just get yourself to Kansas City and you can be there and learn a ton from our friends at Brave Futures. Hope you enjoy the show today.
Sir, the possibility of successfully navigating an asteroid field is approximately 3,720 to 1.
Never tell me the odds.
I'm Pete Mitchell. He's Peyton Jones, and this is the Church Planner Podcast.
Today's podcast is brought to you by New Breed Training. New Breed exists to provide you with courses, cohorts, and resources from the New Breed team, such as yours truly, Andrea Jones, Ralph Moore, Alan Hirsch, Hugh Halter, and many more. To learn to disciple like Jesus so you can plant like Paul, head on over to newbreedtraining.com. And now, back to the Church Planner Podcast.
Hey, Church Planner, this is Pete Mitchell.
And this is Peyton Jones.
And we got a special guest today.
We do. It's my voice. I have sick Barry White voice. No, we have a real guest. We have a real person here. Should I introduce him, Pete?
I think you probably should.
See, I told you my cough made a cameo. We have today with us, we have David Sund. He is the author of a book that I read. And I'm not saying that like I'm surprised that I read it, but I do get sent a lot of books. And so I was really excited to see David on the lineup, and I asked Brooks, and he said, well, you asked me to ask him. So that means, David, I liked your book. And so the book is called Small Batch Discipleship, and it was different. And that was one of the reasons we wanted to have David on here. So David, say hi to all of our kind church planners out there that are here and showing up for Smack Talk, which you're not going to get.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much. I have been a listener and kind of a friend without actually having the chance to be able to bro around with you. And I am a fan of anyone who takes on the task of being entrepreneurial for the kingdom.
Nice. Well, we're a friend of anyone who kind of has your heart, which we spent a little bit of time before this just getting to know you. And I quizzed David about everything that was behind him on the camera. Sometimes you get a guest on here and they just have cool stuff behind him. He was wearing a rad t-shirt that said, "We Defy Darkness." Had to talk about that. He had a Banksy picture up on his wall, which then had an amazing Yahweh Lungs picture, which that sounds weird. I know. You don't pick those up at Kmart or Ross Dress for Less. But he had one and we talked about it. And it was amazing. We were about to talk about books, but we found out that was the Wi-Fi tower, which excited Pete. Mainly because we weren't going to talk about books, except we're going to talk about your book. So into the book.
Wait. Before we get to that, I got to ask him the question.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. All right. So, David.
Yeah.
How did you come to faith?
I grew up in a really notable Christian home. My parents were not in vocational ministry. My mom was an immigrant who fled Nazi-occupied Norway after the war, ended up in San Francisco. My dad was of Norwegian descent, but he had been here a generation. And these were just kind of two godly folks, and we had a community of faith. And there's this picture in Hebrew culture of an insula. It's this extended family of faith, and there's wonderful imagery around what it means to be raised as an extended family of faith. It's where you learn the trade. It's where you would learn, share beliefs. It's where you would have multiple voices speaking into your life. And this is kind of the both the family and the faith family that I was born into. So didn't mean that I wasn't super curious, but I felt like I got introduced to the Lord at a really young age, and then got to see it animated in really authentic ways without the hypocrisy. Mm. So that was in San Francisco with my parents. My mom led for 30 years, she was part of an interdenominational, multicultural women's Bible study for about 140 women for 30 years. She led that. And then my dad was a journeyman carpenter who became a dentist, who became a medical missionary, just because he needed to. It was like the only midlife crisis he ever went through, but he sold his practice and just started going 2 months overseas on a mercy ship.
Mm. Wow.
Wow.
Those my midlife cool. crisis hasn't ended. It just keeps going and trickling into more things.
Well, it's because it started when you met me, Pete.
It did.
I wrecked your world.
Yeah, we want to reinvent ourselves with every album cover or something like that.
Well, I mean, even that, David, like I there was just kind of a sense when we got on here, because I read your book and it was different, like I said, but you're actually, there's just something when I met you, I'm like, this guy's deep. He's interesting. I mean, when you start busting out Hebrew words, and I mean, just being the son of Nazi occupied German, I mean, Nazi occupied immigrants from Europe. Yeah. That's amazing. Like you, it's starting to click into place for me. You have had somewhat of a different upbringing, but, I want to get a little bit into the book. Why did you write small batch disciple making, and what does the term small batch mean?
So one of the things, and again, I grew up in a church that their primary strategy, though not stated, was if you move in here and you raise your family here and you grow old here, you're going to get the goods. You're going to not only get the word, you're going to have the opportunity to teach the word. You're going to have, this is a servant-hearted culture. And there was going to be a lot of compassionate outreach and things like that. The problem is that we don't live in a society anymore that you get to grow old in. And so, when we need to reset and see ourselves as a sending agent, go, what are the deposits that we want to make? Almost like every church needs to see themselves as a college ministry. I'm lucky if I get you for 4 years before you get some career advancement opportunity. That being said, I was in large churches for a long time in programmatic thing. And we need to be honest and acknowledge that, you know, people like Henry Ford were really instrumental in creating the educational system. And it was for efficiency. It was for an assembly line, and it was for mass production. And I feel like the church has largely adopted a strategy that says we want to funnel as many people through our program. So it usually starts with some version of our expression of sexy worship, be it liturgical or rock concert or candles, whatever. And then you kind of get them into a group or a class, and then you kind of, that next level of funnel is ministry participation. And then, you know, you ask them if they can step up and lead a small group, or, you know, and then maybe sit on a board or committee, and you're trying to wrench out, kind of squeak out a mature believer. Hmm. Jesus comes and he turns that 2000 years ago upside down. He's like, I'm trying to train the few to reach the many. Hmm. And so I don't believe that programs disciple people. I think that people disciple people. But here's the thing, even though every church feels like they are answering this sacred calling to make disciples, I start asking all of these earnest Christians who grew up with the whole range of teaching, small group, mission trips, you know, youth group, all the things. And I go, "Wait, could you disciple?" And they're like, I don't actually feel like, I wouldn't know where to start. Mm. I don't feel like I've ever been discipled. And I was like, So I wanted to have something that where we could incarnate or animate a living faith, that we could find fresh language. So for instance, I talk about, instead of talking about evangelism, I talk about hospitality, talk about stewardship, I talk about generosity. Instead of missions, I talk about compassion. It's all the things. But I wanted a way for people to impart and give away a living faith, but also be able to leverage their faith for the benefit of others. Mm. So that was sort of the genesis of the book. And I just started writing this for our faith community and some friends around the country. And thankfully, I got this gracious opportunity that NAV Press said yes to it.
In one of the chapters, you talk about social loafing. Can you unpack that and its relationship to discipleship making?
Yeah, the social loafing effect is that thing that happens in, we talk about community, and I'm a big fan of being in community, but the larger the size graph gets, the less personal responsibility a person has to engage or respond. So if you take that in a church context, a lot of times we're allowed to just come in and be anonymous. And oh, by the way, I want to be honest. Don't call on me. Don't single me out. Don't give me about 6 weeks to warm up, because it just requires a lot of emotional energy to be new. But here's the thing. If we remain anonymous, we end up missing any kind of ownership of the relationships or actually the investment in the work of the ministry. And then all that really produces is a consumptive faith. I think the social loafing effect is part of the impact of Western consumptive Christianity. We're allowed to be anonymous. I mean, if you give a general announcement, "Hey, y'all, we need volunteers," doesn't really work. But if you go and ask someone one-on-one, they're more apt to respond. The social loafing effect is that thing where I can hide in the crowd and respond to the call of God at my leisure and at my convenience. And that's not actually the life of Christ. Mm. It needs to be a courtship, an invitation and challenge. And we just live into that tension, but we do it in community. I'd rather be awkward together, uncomfortable in Matt than uncomfortable by myself, right? But that's what really catalyzes community.
It's interesting that you say that, because Peyton knows this about me. I'm a massive introvert, like just on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm a good 42, 45, something somewhere in that range. Right. And I love going to big churches because I know I can hide.
Yes.
And no one's going to talk to me. And then and my wife will tell you this, my greatest pet peeve is when they go, "All right, now turn to someone you don't know and introduce yourself." And I'm like, Nope, I'm not talking. Like, it's just like, because it's so against, you know, who I am as a person. But so that's why I can relate to that. And yet at our church, you know, we volunteered to lead a small group, and like that's how we were getting to know people. And for a massive introvert like me, that's how I can best like get to know people. It's just, you know, one-on-one, like, come over to our house, we're gonna have dinner, that kind of a thing. And it definitely works a lot better for me and my personality.
Well, and Pete, I get that. I'm relational at heart. Like, I can work for about a day and a half in my home office, and then I was like, yeah, I gotta just be around people, even if I'm not engaging them. Here's what I say though to most people, because I hear that story, and I would say our society is growing more introverted as technology has taken off. So that narrative is more common. But here's what I say on a spiritual level. Every extrovert needs a discipline for contemplation and maybe even solitude. But every introvert needs a spiritual discipline for engagement and being in community. Mm. We're not trying to like make you someone you're not, but like just our time together, Pete, like there's stuff in your head that I need, bro. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
And there's some gold if you give me just a window to open and mine for that. And yeah. And that's where I'm like, that's where it becomes a sacred trust.
This is one of the key things that God is personally speaking to me right now.
Yeah.
I looked at my wife the other night and I said, you know, I've changed a little bit. And I think it probably is due to the technology. But Pete will know this. There is a sense in which when I'm operating in a church plant, I'm on. Like I'm switched on, like, yeah. like 100%. And I've had a few years between church plants. And I'm church planting now, but there has been a difference. Part of it is I believe that there is the idea that we are available to God to invest in the souls and lives of people. And when that metal shutter comes down, and we think this is my time, this is my space, this is my, you know, maybe we're going too far of, you know, hey, I need self-care. I need, you know, all that stuff that's going around. I believe all things in balance, but I believe that what I've done personally is compartmentalize my life to a certain degree where I'm no longer seeing people the way God sees them. I'm yeah. seeing them as NPCs in my life rather than seeing, wait a second, the greatest commandment is to love God and to love your neighbor. That where those two circles overlap, you find Peyton Jones, right? That's yeah. the... And I call that when I do in our discipleology course, I show love God, love others. It's discipleship. That's yeah. where, you know, in the middle where loving God and loving others comes together. You can't do one without the other. But I'm starting to really look at that. And part of this awareness has been triggered by just, I just read the biographies of Lonnie Frisbee. There's three of yeah. them. And his whole thing was he was always switched on, ready to be used by God to invest in others. That was the secret of his entire ministry. And so I hear you saying that. And I'm like, yeah, that's resonating pretty deeply right now. Mm. Well, on a practical level, the book really gets down into the grassroots, trying to help the reader understand a real practical way to evangelize. Can you share a few of these tips with our listeners? Just get their feet wet a bit.
Yeah, So a couple of things I would say. I like to approach evangelism, like I said, in the way of hospitality. I come at it from as someone who was raised, doing those fake surveys and approaching like people cold turkey evangelism, going, hey, we're out here doing a survey and we're just asking people if they died, you know, and stand, what would you say? And oh my gosh, those are a beating. But I wonder, like, if we just took a lesson from Luke chapter 10 and the person of peace, and Jesus sends out them, I call it the Good Commission before it gets to the Great Commission. And he sends them out and he's like, don't take anything with you for the journey. You don't even have to memorize a script. No extra shoes, money belt. But, oh, and by the way, I'm sending you as like sheep among wolves. But my language, look for the friendly eyes. So who are the folks that show you like hospitality, give you work, house you, feed you? And he sent them out. And these were the people that he had prepared in advance. I think the people of God need some kind of sensitivity, some discernment to go, why is this person asking my advice? Why is this person showing me favor, kindness, grace, patience when I didn't earn it or deserve it? And I'm saying, well, maybe it's not you. Maybe the Spirit of God is preparing them in advance for you. So that flips the whole narrative about how we approach doing the work. Now, that being said, you know, I was trained with things like the Romans Road. And the problem with the Romans Road is, while I believe it, while I think it's great, if you start a conversation with, for all of sin and fallen short of the glory of God, you immediately go to moralism. And if you're instilling that in a child, it's very easy. And I've been trying to counsel with grown adults who have a very low view of their love before God. So now we're trying to work at, well, you know, well, because of Jesus, God loves me, but I mostly feel tolerated by him. Well, that there's a way that we can rethink that in how right. we approach the work.
That's powerful.
And so I want to be able to come at it from a different way that feels A, more natural, B, more relational. And then as a church, we were committed to labs, not lectures. Like we wanted to make faith and community accessible because we're living in a time where culturally people are spiritually hungry, but institutionally skeptical. Mm-hmm. So as a young church plant, we were thinking of it two ways. Number one, we wanted to make faith and community accessible because guess what? Most people's next step isn't into your living room Bible study or your worship gathering. Number two, I wanted to take our core community and go, we need to animate a living faith. We want to put the divine on display. And here's how to talk about it. So we had these seven rhythms that I wrote about, and it might be compassion, which is all we're learning to do is see others' needs as simply different than my own. But in the end, we're all needy. Or, you know, generosity is, hey, we're doing this event because we don't give to save anyone necessarily. We give to save ourselves from believing we deserve what God's already provided, you know. And we were trying to use this kind of outward facing accessibility to disciple our church in an animated and a living way.
And now a message from our sponsor. At Reliant, we understand that the journey towards financial sustainability and church planting can be tough, especially when you're charting new paths. That's where we step in alongside you as a partner. With our biblically based support raising training and coaching, we empower you to invite others to partner with you in the work that God is doing in and through your church plant. But we don't stop there. We also partner with you by handling back-end employment services like payroll, HR support, and comprehensive benefits like medical, dental, and even offer a 403b9 retirement plan. Our goal? Freeing you up to spend even more time sharing the gospel in your contacts. Oh, and did we mention being able to do it in a healthy and sustainable way yet? If you visit reliant.org/CPP today, you can learn more and also get access to the three videos addressing the questions. Is support raising biblical and applicable to today? These three videos are a preview of our training, and we hope they will encourage you as you invite others to be gospel partners with you. Our heart, like yours, is to see more healthy and sustainable church plants. You have the vision, mission, and passion for this church plant. We can help. Visit reliant.org/CPP today to learn more and get your free resource. Now, back to the Church Planner Podcast.
That's really good. I love, you know, even as you're talking about this, I'm thinking about how evangelism often has been communicated through the vehicle of salesmanship.
Yes.
That you're selling the gospel like a product. And I'm, you know, I'm sure that for an evangelist, they're like, yeah, you know, but, you know, there's four other functions of Christ's ministry, including shepherds. And I've got a shepherd I'm planting with right now. You cannot get him to sell anything, but he will serve people and love people all day long. And I think that's kind of the deal is it really brings it to when you serve someone or even like the miracles Jesus did. Right? Yeah. It was grace. Every activity that Jesus operated in was bringing an experience of grace before they had an understanding of grace. So when you serve someone, you're demonstrating undeserved favor, grace to them. They get to experience it before they believe it.
Oh, that's good. That is good. I love that. One of the ways, and this kind of goes back to a little bit of our earlier question, and I talk about this in the book. If you look at the miracles of Jesus, because the church often is looking for results when we should be looking for fruit. But if you look at the miracles of Jesus, I would almost argue that most of them were illustrative. Jesus was not interested in a ministry to the masses. And so I use the example of, look at the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000. If you do the kind of layered work, it looks rather unremarkable. Not that it's not powerful, but if you're sitting there, arguably 15 to 20,000 people on a hillside, there's no jumbotron. There's no public address system. Who actually knows a miracle's unfolding? And I'm saying, the 12 ushers going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, these baskets aren't emptied. Like, that's a really interesting thing. And there is something very intentional that Jesus is doing, not to woo the crowds, but to invest in the few.
Yeah. Yeah. And it even says when they get in the boat after feeding the five and four that they didn't understand the lessons of the lesson of the loaves. And you're like, we're never told what that is, but there was some lesson Jesus was trying to teach them. I think we could figure it out, but you're right. All those miracles were done with an illustrative point.
But to your point, the grace of God was at work. And what do we find? All those people went and found him on the other side of the lake because they're still looking for more fish and chips. They're like, this is a meal train. And so grace does that. Grace draws us in. Grace compels us. I got something I didn't deserve.
That's now great. Since you guys are in Texas, I think I'll quote the late great J. Vernon McGee. If Jesus were alive today, he'd put Weber's out of business. I remember him saying that about the feeding of 5,000. Cracked me up.
Oh, I don't know what Weber's is.
It was a white bread.
Okay,
it's what we are.
Okay. I was like, I don't know what that is, but
all right. I guess it's like Wonder Bread or something.
Yeah, it's like Wonder Bread.
I know J. Vernon McGee, but don't know that. Let me ask you, what's the largest misconception about disciple making?
Okay, here's the thing. And this, I might pick a fight with this, and that's okay. Whatever. I'm secure in my masculinity. We can have this discussion. Mm-hmm. Discipleship. I've even stopped using that word. I talk about it as disciple making. I wanted to shift it from a noun to a verb. But the conversations always, not always, I want to speak in less extreme. I think there's a way people talk about discipleship as sacramental. You talk to your, like, kind of your Anglican friends or whatever, and it's, oh yeah, these inward, outward expressions that are, boy, they are getting discipled in the liturgy. I was like, yeah, that's great. Then you hear it, oh, it's cognition. You just need to know and grow. And it's kind of attached to volunteerism. Help us with the kids, help us be a greeter, you know, all the things. And then I hear it talk about as like mentoring as advice giving. There's these expressions that people like, this is discipleship. It's it's acts of service. It's acting the way a Christian should act. All of those things are yes, but where I don't think we have enough conversation is disciple making that leads to a commissioning. It needs to be reproductive. The analogy that I love most, guys, is if you study like 12-step recovery, and there's lots of flavors of recovery groups. But step one is when we go, oh yeah, hey, I've got a problem and I am powerless to do anything on my own. And then you take about 10 steps of basically making amends for being a jerk. You're making amends because your addiction spoke louder than your intention. I mean, how many people do we know who've come out of recovery and have just burnt so many bridges and hurt people they love? But here's the thing. The genius of recovery ministry, why it's a movement, why it's not a program, why it has no overhead, why it doesn't require staffing. The genius is step 12, sponsorship.
Mm.
If the church could figure out how to work out their salvation like an addict works out their sobriety, go find someone and say, yeah, you still have further to go. Yeah, you're still working through temptation. Yeah, you still have more to learn. Take what you do have in Christ and start to give it away with someone who's going, hey, my name's Dave. I've got a problem and I'm powerless to do anything about it.
Hmm. I love it, man. Well, I've got the last question, which, you know, I hope the listener, you know, is picking up a flavor that Dave is, he's very authentic, and very, very real.
He's a Texan.
No, Pete, he's a Californian.
No, we shed that.
I got to tell you, like in Texas, you bury the lead and don't like divulge, like you take off your California plates as soon as you get here.
Right.
But my family's from Norway. So my son is Bjorn and my daughter is Annika. But they readily identify with Texas. And I had a friend say, you know, you're from where your kids are from. And I was like, what? I'm a Texan. All right.
That's funny. That's funny.
It's been 18 years now.
I love that. I will have you know, I drop this every chance I get, that I am a direct descendant of Ragnar Lothbrok. I just have to make that be known.
Shut up.
I am directly descendant, you before. Brother.
I liked you before, but I kind of puffy heart you now.
Yeah, it's why I can't have nice things. You know, I mean, look at me, look at my life. I can't have nice things. You know, I break them. I just want to raid and pillage everything. So, but you know, after a while, I reformed and build things. So I'm 50 now. I think I'm in my peaceful Ragnar stage. But, anyways, man, we you know, really just hearing everything that you're saying, brother, you're just selling a book that needs to be read. But I'm going to ask you to brag on your book a little bit, which, you know, probably knowing you in the brief time I've known you, you're probably not going to like to do that. So, obviously your book was different, which is why we got you on here. What makes your book stand out from other titles about discipleship?
That was very gracious, and I appreciate that. I just want to see the people of God be able to flourish. We are an increasingly growing into an increasingly post-Christian era. Mm. But I believe the church can thrive from a minority position. And I've done a deep dive in the last 2,000 years of disciple-making and revival movements as a part of some research I'm doing. And there's two emerging themes that I get really super hopeful about. Number one is the church can thrive from a minority position, but it will require the church to adapt and evolve. And we see globally where there is no religious freedom in places like China, and even the church in Iran is exploding and it's being primarily led by women. Mm. It's so exciting. So the church in the West needs to be able to adapt and evolve, and so that we can thrive from a minority position. The second thing that is, I think, the hand of God, when God does a new work, it is typically from the bottom up, not the top down. And that is good news. So I wanted to write something that feels like I can do this as an ordinary Christian. It's shifting the narrative that we have built in America that says discipleship is sitting at the feet of religious elites or clergy, mm-hmm, versus ordinary small batch disciple making that is in the shadow of.
Mm.
This was the model of Jesus, a Hebraic model.
Yes.
We've adopted the Greek model, which was, oh, what college you go to? Well, I'm going to University of Texas. Well, what's your major? Oh, I'm studying engineering. Okay. In the Hebrew model, it was, well, who did you study? Well, I studied under Paul, or I was under Gamaliel, or I was under Peter. And oh, if you got under that guy, you got the goods.
Yeah.
And if our people could have more imagination for being able to impart a living faith, and this is an advanced degree, what about if the people of God started to see their life? They are the syllabus, and their experience with Christ is the curriculum.
Wow.
Go give that away.
Come on.
And all I tried to do was just say, oh, here's some fun ways you could do this. Here's some words. The back of each book, I wrote this as more of a field guide. I wanted people, if they've never been discipled, to be able to almost do their own lesson planning. Each rhythm has a kind of section at the end. It's called Finding Your Rhythm. I just want you to find the words to articulate the difference Christ is making.
Mm.
And like most of us just like, I ran out of runway to have this conversation. I was like, okay, let me build the runway because you can do that because God's already giving you the influence. I would say this last thing. Sociologists tell us that even the most introverted of people will influence over 10,000 people in their lifetime.
Wow. My goodness.
So Pete, put that in your pipe and smoke it as an introvert.
Well, ironically, I love public speaking and I train a ton of real estate agents. Has nothing to do with the gospel, but I do influence people. But yeah, it's the irony of me.
But Pete, the kingdom of God is inside of you. Like that's the beauty of it. And so you don't even need to say Jesus when you're teaching like real estate instruction. There is something that, you know, we are image bearers committed to faithful presence anyway.
Yeah, there's more going on. And I keep hearing about songwriters and musicians, and famous musicians that the more you scratch at the surface of their life, you read a biography, the more you find that there was more going on inside of them than anybody knew.
Yes.
Just got done reading Scott Weiland's Weiland's book, Not Dead, Not for Sale, which Stone Temple Pilots.
Yes.
And that dude was thinking and singing about God more than anyone knew and trying to walk his own walk with God through the midst of his battle with addiction. Just amazing. But you're right. The kingdom of God, it made sense because I've been a diehard STP fan since, you know, Purple. And, you know, to just now, it, you know, 30 years on, read this biography and be like, I knew it. You know, there was something in that dude. I knew it. But, you know,
I saw Scott Weiland here in Austin at La Zona Rosa doing us like it wasn't the whole STP. It was just him.
No, come on. That would have been awesome. And
it was probably a venue for about 300 to 400 people. That dude could have commanded a stadium. He had a gift. And here's the thing that maybe every church planter needs to know is that with every gift, there's a shadow side that we all have to contend with. But maybe the flip side of that is, what if we reimagine our gifts or our weaknesses as simply undeveloped strengths? And this is the redemptive nature of what God wants to do and how we live into the resurrection. Like, it wasn't just a promise for one man. It was a promise for all time, for all people. And he wants to bring new life again and again and as needed when necessary. And so I think that there's a way that God wants to continue to refine and do something new. Scott Weiland is such a great example of that, where a guy just managing, like a bunch of pastors, the shadow side of brilliance, of vision, of charisma.
Yeah, it's why Pete's so smart and brilliant. He has a big shadow side, but we're not going to talk about that. But the reality is, anyone who wants to be used of God, right? Unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it cannot bear fruit. There is a cost. There is always a cost just to fruitfulness. There's a cost to discipleship. I mean, Bonhoeffer titled his book that. I mean, there's always a cost. And that's what I love about your book is you're not just talking about the cost. You're also talking about the joy, you know, that small batch, that crafting something like bourbon or coffee or a woodworker, you know, someone who's just, they're a craftsman. You're crafting another soul in the image of Jesus. And that's such a powerful picture. But we're out of time today. Guys, our guest has been David Sund. He is an author with NAB Press. He has written the book, Small Batch Disciple Making. For sure, grab a copy of this. He is a church planter. We didn't talk much about his experience with church planting, but he has planted. He also is someone who can let go of the ring of power and go on. You are going to be seeing more of him. He will be writing more books. He feels God has called him to a greater audience. And David, it has certainly been a pleasure, an absolute joy to have you on this show, brother. You've just dropped solid gold the whole time. And I hope, man, we get you back on here again.
Oh, that would be awesome. Like, I have just loved what you guys are bringing, and as just a resource to guys in the trenches, to gals who just needing a fresh word and a little bit of encouragement. So as one of those people, I'm just like, thank you so much for what you're doing, because this is a side hustle and you guys are still in the trenches with the Bride of Christ. And I love it. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Hey, if they want to catch up with you, where can they find you?
Yeah, so I have a website, davidsunde.com, S-U-N-D-E, and I'm doing some fun stuff. I'm trying to build some relational infrastructure around this book for all those folks. It's a grassroots, kind of decentralized, peer-led cohort for people who just want to animate the faith, live on mission, but with a covenant towards reproducing and God raising up their own apprentice. And I just launched a few groups around the country. And so I'd love to be able to have that conversation if folks are interested.
All right. Well, that sounds good. So go check him out. And guys, thanks for joining us today. And on behalf of Church Planner Podcast, thank you, David, to you. And we will see you next time on our Church Planner Podcast. Pete, sign us out.
If you want to reach the ones that nobody's reaching, you got to go where nobody's going and do what nobody's doing.
Hey there, bivocational pastors. Are you tired of spinning your wheels, trying to juggle your church duties and provide for your family? Well, hold on tight, because I've got some game-changing news for you. It's time to unveil missionbybusiness.com, the holy grail of training programs crafted exclusively for bivocational pastors like you. We get it. Your time is sacred, and you deserve a money-making solution that won't suck up every minute of your day. In just 9 short weeks, you'll become a powerhouse, armed with the secrets to launch your own business using the mind-blowing force of artificial intelligence. Yep, AI is going to be your secret weapon. Now it's time to stop dreaming and start acting. Head over to missionbybusiness.com and feast your eyes on our masterclass video, which covers everything in much more detail. It's time to build a business that fuels your dreams, supports your church, and provides for your family. Don't wait another moment. Seize this opportunity with both hands. Head on over to missionbybusiness.com now.